This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan at the Newseum in Washington, D.C. It's press preview day here at this remarkable new Museum of Journalism. The building opens to the public on Friday. Today we're broadcasting from the Knight Studio, a state-of-the-art facility filled with high-definition cameras and fiber-optic cables and an audience of reporters, editors, producers, and bloggers. And welcome to you all. The First Amendment to the Constitution is engraved on huge blocks of stone on the front of this building, and there are an awful lot of journalists who believe that Congress shall make no law that infringes on freedom of the press must include a reporter's right to protect confidential sources. Anonymous leaks played critical roles in the Pentagon Papers, Watergate, Enron, and Abu Ghraib, and many journalists believe the bond between a reporter and a source is sacred. Many states protect that relationship with so-called shield laws, but there is no such protection under the federal law. In recent years, several journalists spent time in jail rather than reveal their sources. Now, as Congress considers a federal shield law, administration officials argue that all of those important stories I just mentioned managed to find their way to the front page despite the absence of a federal shield law, that sometimes journalists are the only witnesses to crimes, and that one big difference between states and the federal government is the issue of national security. Later in the hour, we'll visit one of the interactive exhibits here at the museum. We'll leave the Knight Studio, go downstairs. You'll have a chance to play an interactive ethics game with us. But first, reporters and their sources. If you're a reporter or a prosecutor, give us a call. Do you think that a source's anonymity should be protected? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can visit our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation, and we'll take questions from the audience here at the museum as well. And we begin with Tony Losi, now a professor of journalism at West Virginia University, formerly a reporter for USA Today, where she wrote stories about the investigation into the anthrax attacks that followed shortly after 9/11. Then Attorney General John Ashcroft identified an Army scientist named Stephen Hatfield as a person of interest, and Losi's stories quoted anonymous sources who identified him as a suspect. Hatfield was never charged. He blames those sources for ruining his career. He sued the government, and a federal judge ordered Losi, among others, to name her sources. An appeals court will hear the case next month. Tony Losi joins us now from the studios of West Virginia Public Radio in Morgantown, West Virginia, and it's good of you to be with us today.
And thank you.
Why is it important to protect sources who were evidently wrong?
No, my sources were not wrong. The stories that I wrote were accurate and fair and skeptical of the FBI's focus on Dr. Hatfield. No, my sources were not wrong.
Are you saying that they spoke in good faith or that their information was correct?
Their information was correct. Dr. Hatfield was indeed the focus of the FBI's investigation, and Attorney General John Ashcroft had identified him as such.
He'd identified him as a person of interest.
Correct. And that's a term that does not exist in the U.S. Attorney's Manual. There are other terms that carry certain legal connotations, like suspect, target of an investigation. But person of interest was a brand new term that even law enforcement officials had never heard of before the Attorney General used it. But the stories that I wrote raise questions through my sources about the focus on Dr. Hatfield and whether the FBI had been premature in focusing on him to the exclusion of others.
And indeed, that has proven to be the case. Judge Reggie Walton, the federal judge in this case, has said there was not a scintilla of evidence against Stephen Hatfield, and of course he was never charged. Given that, where does he go to get his good name back?
He has every right to sue. Of course, that's the American way. But there has to be a balance. I mean, he does have a right to be compensated for the wrong that was done to him. But my concern is that he not be able to destroy the First Amendment in the process.
But how does he do that unless you and others, you're not the only reporter involved here, but how does he do that unless you and others say who did it to him?
Well, I think what he does is he has a videotape of the Attorney General identifying him as a person of interest. At a hearing in January, Dr. Hatfield's lawyers told Judge Walton that they were ready to go to trial, that they had a mountain of evidence, that they had what they needed, and that they and the judge actually warned Dr. Hatfield's lawyers that they had to go, if they wanted a trial date, they'd have to go without information from me and Jim Stewart from CBS. And they were fine with that. But something changed between January and February when Judge Walton held me in contempt.
Mm-hmm. And again, your case comes up for appellate review in May. But tell us, if there was a federal shield law, would you have been perfectly protected here? You would never have been subpoenaed? You'd never been asked?
Well, I think that what would happen under the proposed legislation is that it would require judges to do a balancing test to look at the harm that was done to Dr. Hatfield versus the public's interest in the stories that were written about him. And you have to keep in mind that the anthrax attacks represented the first biological attack on U.S. soil. There is no way that the press could have ignored writing about the anthrax attacks. The public was terrified, if you remember what it was like in those days, in October 2001. You had the Capitol shut down. You had people afraid to open their mail. You had thousands of people on antibiotics in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. The public was genuinely frightened by the anthrax attacks. And the press would have been irresponsible had we not written a word about the investigation and the subsequent identification of Dr. Hatfield as a person of interest.
And what harm would it do at this point to reveal those sources?
Well, because these sources are not just sources who may have helped me on stories about Dr. Hatfield. These sources helped me on far more sensitive stories about terrorism generally. And some of these people had absolutely nothing to do with any information about Dr. Hatfield. So it would be basically outing people who are perfectly innocent.
That is involved in the case. You've told the judge you can't remember specifically which people gave you this information. Therefore, he's asked you for all of the sources on the story.
That's correct.
And as I understand it, if the appellate court agrees with him, and if it stops there, then you're going to start facing fines beginning at, what, $500 a day, escalating to $5,000 a day, and fines to you personally, not to your newspaper or former newspaper.
That's correct. Judge Walton has banned anyone, including my family, my students, from having a bake sale. No one can help me, according to Judge Walton's order.
Tony Losi, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it. Have good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Tony Losi now teaches journalism at West Virginia University, formerly a reporter for USA Today, and she joined us from West Virginia Public Radio in Morgantown. Mark Granis, a partner at Harris, Wiltshire & Granis, represents Dr. Stephen Hatfield. In March, he wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal called The Justice and the Press. You can find a link to that piece on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Mark Granis, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you very much.
And why, in your article, you said a shield law would be bad for the country. Looking at the evidence in this case, why?
Well, I think that we have to have laws in the country that define how we use information. Reasonable minds can differ about what those laws should be. We could have a very open society where your Social Security number and your credit card number and everything is open to public inspection. Thank goodness we don't have that. Most of us feel, I think, that there should be some areas of our lives that are not open to public scrutiny, even if the government has a good reason for collecting information on us. Now, we have a law called the Privacy Act that requires government agencies to keep information that they keep on all of us secret. And in this case, they violated that law. Whatever you think about laws restricting the flow of information, whether it's classified information, whether it's personal privacy type information, whatever you think about that, reporters live under the rule of law like the rest of us. Every citizen has a duty to expose the violation of those laws when they have evidence of that. And reporters are citizens, too. They have the same obligation of truth-telling in court that all the rest of us do.
Yet, as we just heard, if those sources are dried up because they're going to be identified or easily identified, it's going to be hard for reporters like Tony Losi to get stories about investigations into the anthrax attacks, those sorts of things. And as she said, her stories did raise a lot of questions about the FBI's priorities in this case.
Well, the claim that sources will dry up is what the media says, and I don't have any reason to question the good faith with which they say it. But it's unavoidably an empirical question. And as it happens, we have over 200 years of empirical evidence on this question. Reporters have never had the right to make private promises of confidentiality that trump a valid subpoena. It has never existed. 35 years ago, the Supreme Court said that this claim wasn't even raised in the law until 1958. It never existed in the common law. It has never been accepted since then. There are...
On the federal level.
Or on the state level. There are some states that have shield laws. In fact, most states have shield laws. And I think the reporters' lobby tries to present that as a unified picture of all the states have these laws and the federal government doesn't. Well, you know, 50 states have flags, too, but that doesn't mean they all look alike. And many of the states, judicial protection is the norm rather than statutory protection, and the reporters already have powerful judicial protection at the federal level as well.
You wrote in your piece that if there were a shield law, there would be very little to protect people from, less than honest reporters.
That's absolutely correct. There is the Watergate example. There's the Pentagon Papers example. But, you know, nobody gets subpoenaed in those cases. The subpoenas tend to come in cases where the press allows itself to be used and lines up with the powerful and against the innocent. And in those cases, the courts have to be able to do justice. Most leakers, as far as I can tell, work at night for the same reason that burglars do.
Okay. We're going to talk about reporters and their sources this hour. Coming up, Matthew Cooper, a reporter at Time magazine, when he faced jail time to protect his sources, will also speak with an attorney at the Department of Justice. And we'll take your calls. Join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We'll be taking questions from the studio audience here at the museum as well. So fill out those little cards and pass them over, and we'll get you up to the microphone soon. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, broadcasting live from the museum. We've been talking about one of the most controversial tools in a reporter's kit, confidential sources. And when prosecutors go after sources, reporters can sometimes face jail time. If you're a reporter or a prosecutor, give us a call. Do you think a source's anonymity should be protected? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And let's get a caller in on the line. This is Bruce from Hayward in California.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
I was a reporter at one time in my life. I have an undergraduate bachelor's degree in journalism. And I believe that for the most part, confidential sources should be protected if, and there's a big if, the public has benefited from the information. Now, let's take the Valerie Plame case. The public never benefited from anything there, and sources should not have been protected. But in most cases where the information benefits the public, something has been discovered that would not have been, then the sources should be protected.
How do you decide? Who gets to decide which is in the public benefit?
I think it would be pretty obvious. I mean, in my case, I think the reporter can decide, but the reporter should show some judgment. I believe in the Valerie Plame case, the public got no benefit whatsoever from revealing Valerie Plame's association with the CIA. There was absolutely no benefit there. Therefore, no sources should have been protected.
All right. Let's listen to the special prosecutor in that case, Patrick Fitzgerald, who argued that information reporters had about their sources was central to his case at a news conference in 2005. Fitzgerald said he took a hard line reluctantly.
I do not think that reporters should be subpoenaed anything close to routinely. It should be an extraordinary case. But if you're dealing with a crime, and what's different here is the transaction is between a person and a reporter. They're the eyewitness to the crime. The only way you can do an investigation like this is to hear from all the witnesses. I wish Ms. Miller spent not a second in jail, but I think it had to be done.
That was the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald. Of course, he was referring to Judith Miller, then of the New York Times. Also with us here is Matt Cooper, Washington editor of Portfolio Magazine. During the Valerie Plame leak investigation, Matt Cooper was subpoenaed, threatened with 18 months in prison. Ultimately, he testified in front of a grand jury when his confidential source, Karl Rove, granted him permission to identify him. Matt Cooper is here at the museum. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks, Neil.
And I wonder, what do you make of this conversation here and the comment that the public benefit has to weigh in?
Well, let's just step back a second, Neil. You know, the thing that reporters are asking for in this law that's before Congress right now is a privilege not to have to testify in certain cases. Now, right now, that privilege through common law and statute is afforded to priests and penitents, clients and their lawyers, doctors and patients, husbands and wives, social workers and their clients. It's a privilege that's rather common in law. As you noted before, at the state level, reporters have protections in 49 of the 50 states to varying degrees, but there are protections. So what reporters are asking for here from Congress is to be included in that. And why do we have those protections? Because society has decided that those relationships are so important, and the candor in those relationships are so important, that we don't make husbands testify against wives. We don't make priests testify about their parishioners. I believe, and apparently a bipartisan majority in Congress is coming to the same belief, that that same privilege in a balanced and limited way should apply to journalists as well because of what we do and because of the information we garner. And that's where I come down as well.
Well, let's hear a dissenting opinion, if you will. Joining us by phone from his office is Kevin Driscoll, an attorney at the Department of Justice's Criminal Division. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And why is the department opposed to a federal shield law for reporters?
Well, the department's opposition, I should note at the outset, we're not alone in opposing this bill. We've been joined by the Director of National Intelligence, the entire intelligence community, Secretaries of Defense, Energy, and Homeland Security, in expressing opposition. But the department's position is really a threefold objection. One, there hasn't really been, in our view, a demonstration, an empirical demonstration, that this bill is necessary. The Supreme Court ruled on this issue in the Brandsburg case, which I'm sure you've discussed, and which decided that the First Amendment did not provide a privilege to journalists to shield sources from a validly issued grand jury subpoena. In the 36 years since Brandsburg, we've seen a veritable explosion of information available on all topics to the public. So we really don't think that there's been a chilling effect in the absence of a federal shield law on sources. Second of all, to the extent that protections are necessary, the department has voluntarily imposed restrictions on its prosecutors and their ability to issue grand jury subpoenas to members of the news media. And as Mr. Fitzgerald in the clip you played earlier said, though that policy reflects a sentiment in the department that such subpoenas should be, and in fact are, exceedingly rare. And in fact, for the types of information that this legislation covers, which is to say confidential source information, those subpoenas have been exceedingly rare. According to our own statistics here at the department, we've authorized the issuance of subpoenas seeking confidential source information in fewer than two dozen cases since 1991. And the third reason is that this bill goes far beyond just grand jury subpoenas and would pose serious risks and obstacles to not just criminal investigations up to and including investigations of terrorism, but also intelligence investigations and vital intelligence gathering tools that this bill, at least on its terms as currently written, would extend to and would impede. So that's really the threefold nature of the department's opposition to the bill.
Matt Cooper, I wonder if you have a response.
Well, I guess myself and a bipartisan majority in Congress feels differently. You know, this bill has the backing not just of a few wild-eyed liberals, but a lot of conservative Republicans who are tough on law and order. You know, we have experience at the state level with shield laws, and criminals get prosecuted, law enforcement does its job. There are ways to structure these laws so that you're not, you know, granting a total and absolute privilege in all cases. This bill is written with all kinds of exceptions in it, and I think it's a balanced approach. And I must say, two dozen subpoenas may not seem a lot since 1991. If you're facing jail for going for revealing a source, it's a lot.
But what about Mr.
Fewer than two dozen cases, not 2,000. Two dozen.
I said two dozen.
I apologize. I didn't search it.
But what about Mr. Driscoll's point that in the past 36 years, in the absence of a shield law, we've had a large number of pretty hot stories hit the front page?
Well, absolutely. Look, I think there's largely through custom rather than law, most prosecutors don't subpoena journalists. And that's, I think there's been a kind of stasis. You know, in general, you know, when reporters have been subpoenaed and there's been a conflict, they may have been in jail a couple of days. Some have stayed much longer. But in general, these things have gotten worked out. Prosecutors, I think, for the most part, have shown enormous restraint. I think the reason the media and so many in Congress are eager to pass this law is because we can't always be sure that that gentleman's agreement between prosecutors and reporters will always be there. We may face a future where prosecutors feel much less encumbered to subpoena reporters. They have shown, I think, admirable restraint till now, but they may not in the future. And it would be good simply to extend the same privileges that are available in 49 states to the federal courts.
Kevin Driscoll, I know you've got to run, but we'll give you one more shot.
Sure. The first point I would make is that certainly Mr. Cooper is correct about the state level, but the state level doesn't have to deal with the range of issues, including national security, terrorism, and leaks of classified information that federal prosecutors do. Second of all, I would argue that the reason there has been restraint, and I thank Mr. Cooper for acknowledging that, because I do believe he's correct, and there has been a sort of a good faith agreement. But the derivation of that restraint is the department's own guidelines, which govern every federal prosecutor in every case, whether civil or criminal, at the federal level. And the reason there has been this, what he called gentleman's agreement, is because of that policy, which is rather rigorous and ensures that it's only in, as Mr. Fitzgerald said in the clip you played earlier, in the exceptionally rare case that we issue subpoenas to members of the news media.
Kevin Driscoll, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, sir.
Kevin Driscoll joined us by phone. He's an attorney at the Department of Justice in the Criminal Division. Let's go to a question from the audience here at the museum on my right.
Thanks, Neil. I'm Diane Sines. I'm a former journalist with the Washington Post. I'm now with Ocean Conservation Group, Oceana. My question is for Matt Cooper. In the Valerie Plame case, did your news organization pressure you to reveal your source or sources to the federal grand jury? And why, especially when Richard Armitage admitted to being the first source?
Official at the State Department. Go ahead, Matt Cooper.
No, quite the opposite. I worked for Time Magazine at the time, and no, they did not pressure me to reveal my source. We debated long and hard about how to deal with this question. Ultimately, we decided that we worked out one. I had two confidential sources that were under a subpoena. The first was Scooter Libby. The second was Karl Rove. Eventually, we managed to get agreements with both of them, but not because my company pressured me to make such a deal.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. This is Ronell. Ronell with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my question and giving me the chance to comment. I'm actually a law professor at the University of Arizona's College of Law, and have just completed an empirical study on the question of subpoenas that was actually driven by some of the dichotomy that you're hearing here, with one side of this debate saying that there's been an avalanche of these sorts of subpoenas and the other side of the debate saying that they're very rare. So I crafted a study to try to see what the true numbers look like.
And what do they look like?
We surveyed the editors of every daily newspaper in the United States and every television newsroom affiliated with a major network, and asked them to self-report their subpoenas from just one calendar year, 2006. And a total of 43 actually reported subpoenas from 2006 sought the name of confidential sources. 21 of those were in conjunction with federal subpoenas. And there were 54 reported subpoenas that sought other information obtained under a promise of confidentiality, 13 of which were in conjunction with federal proceedings. So these numbers were significantly larger than the sort of rarity that is being cited by at least some opponents of the federal shield law from the Department of Justice.
Mark Granis, let me ask you, is this volume, this increasing, apparently increasing volume of subpoenas for reporters, is that an issue of concern? Does that change the equation in your mind at all?
Well, I didn't hear evidence of an increase. I heard evidence for 1 year, so I don't know whether it's increasing or not. And the number of subpoenas doesn't sound like a lot to me. I know that if you are the one person who receives that subpoena, it must be very, very disconcerting, and I'm sure it's an event that you don't forget in your life. You probably never forget being identified as a person of interest in the anthrax investigation either. And the problem with what I hear from the press is that these news organizations and these reporters, it's understandable that they want nothing to do with this. It's understandable that they want to be left alone and that they don't want to have to pay the costs of doing justice for all these victims. But by the same token, the victims of these leaks do not want to bear all of the cost for our First Amendment freedoms. And if you say, yeah, we're really sorry about the illegal leaks, but that's just, you know, Dr. Hatfield's just going to have to work that out on his own, you're saying, thanks, Steve. Thanks for standing up and paying for our First Amendment freedoms. It's all you.
Thanks very much for the call, Ronell.
Thank you.
That you just heard, Mark Granis, who's the attorney for Stephen Hatfield, the person of interest. Also with us is Matt Cooper, Washington editor of Portfolio Magazine. We're at the museum today, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to the mic here from the studio.
Hi, my name is Margot Humphreys, and I'm a journalism student at Georgetown University. My question is also for Mr. Granis. In the early 20th century, Walter Lippmann argued for the role of the media to be more as a watchdog of government policy and processes. To what extent do you think that the federal subpoena ability trumps that role for the media? And what sort of implications can that have for the government?
I don't think that subpoenas trump the press's role as watchdog. In fact, I think part of the peculiar genius of the whole American system is that nobody holds all the trump. There are lots of watchdogs in our government, and generally they're all watching each other. And I am here today trying to use the press to halt abuses in the press. I'm aware of that. So more discussion is good, freedom of the press is wonderful, and of course the press plays an important role. But the press also can't claim infallibility. And sometimes, maybe with the best of intentions, people wind up passing along smears, anonymous smears, that should never see the light of the day. And when that happens, courts need to step in to do justice for the victims. If there's corruption at the courthouse, I want the press to report on that. Everybody watches everybody. That's the watchdog system.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Let's get a caller in. This is David. David with us from Northport. Where is Northport?
Northport, just below Sarasota in southwest Florida.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Yeah, the question is, who's going to be the person to decide who is a reporter? And, you know, you compared earlier reporters to priests or to spouses or to lawyers, but those are very objective standards. In this case, wouldn't this just open up anybody who has a blog or has an Internet site to be a reporter and therefore would be covered by a shield?
Matt Cooper?
Well, this is a question that got raised in the federal hearings that I went through in my case. You know, I think one judge raised the specter of bloggers with nukes, that basically, you know, would someone leak nuclear secrets to a friend, the friend would have a blog and just put it out there, and what could you do to stop that if they were a journalist? And it was a hypothetical question, but not an unfair one. Again, I think if you look to the states, we have experience. There are definitions in these various state laws of what a journalist is. You know, they can be defined as the medium that they they're employed by. That's not always the best. I believe in this statute, it's written in a way that someone who devotes their fullest time and energy to reporting. I admit that it is a shady area because journalists are not in this country licensed, and it's not a clear standard. It's not a priesthood that only a few can be a part of.
And the letter from the Justice Department said, look, you could have terrorists who are pose as journalists too.
Well, and I think the statute as written now has all kinds of balancing tests for national security and such. I feel pretty comfortable that if it comes down to these questions, judges can sort out that question of who really is defined as a journalist.
Mark Granis?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question, and I think it underscores part of why the analogy to other kinds of legal privileges really doesn't work here. You know, we don't have a legal privilege for lawyers that says lawyers don't have to testify about anything. We don't have a legal privilege for doctors that says doctors don't have to testify about anything. We have legal privileges for lawyers and their clients about certain kinds of conversations that are undertaken for a certain purpose. We have privileges about doctors and their patients. We have priests and penitents, and not at cocktail hour, but in the confessional. These legal privileges are all very narrowly defined, and so the problem with just saying that reporters have a privilege is you're looking at only one side of the equation, even if you can decide who the reporter is. You have to have maybe a reporter and a source or something like that.
David, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate
it.
And our thanks to our guests here at the museum, Mark Granis, you just heard, of the attorney for Stephen Hatfill, and Matt Cooper, Washington editor at Portfolio Magazine. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Neil.
Coming up, we're going to play an ethics game with you. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.